Who shall I say is speaking?
Owen Kennedy, Druid of Gaia. That's not something I can really communicate with just images and emotions. It's a name couched in language, and she has a spot of trouble with it.
Oaken... Druid of Gaia?
Owen Kennedy, Druid of Gaia. The last part is the important bit to get right. I am representing Gaia, the whole Earth, and her elementals, including Amazon.
Whoa. Is this really happening right now? It seems like a funky dream.
I promise it's real. Can I get Pachamama's attention for me?
Oh, yeah, I'll try, Oaken Druid of Gaia.
I don't mind her messing up me name like that. I kind of like it, really. Maybe I can convince the elementals to call me Oaken Druid someday. There has to be some way to get them to change that. It's almost a full minute before I get a response, but when I do, feckin' hells, it nearly liquefies me brains.
Who are you?
The mental voice would be a pleasant alto if it weren't like a jackhammer in me skull. I can tell the sloth feels it too, because she closes her eyes, whimpers, and nearly falls off the branches she's clutching. Poor lass won't have a good day if that keeps up. I'm Owen Kennedy, a druid of Gaia, sent to you at the request of the Amazon Elemental. Thank you for speaking to me, Pachamama. But could ye maybe take that volume down a few notches? That hurt. The seething mass of creatures shifts its attention from the city across the river to me. All these eyes, compound and binocular, looking at me. We definitely have Pachamama's attention. Her answer is modulated to the loudish range of normal when she replies.
A druid of Gaia. There was one before who visited my forest from time to time. Human with red hair. You are not he?
No, that was me apprentice.
What do you want? I'm busy.
I wanted to talk about why you're busy. You are a nurturing spirit. What has you so upset?
There rained fire down on my forest. Not to clear land to grow food, but to destroy.
Do you mean humans? Well, that wasn't them.
There are no volcanoes here. This fire was unnatural, which means humans were responsible. They cannot be allowed to continue.
It was a volcano, in a sense, but far away from here, on the other side of the world, a fire giant from another plane came to Earth and erupted. Fire is rained down all over the planet, not just here, and humans were not responsible.
I don't care!
She booms, and when both me and the sloth wince, she quiets, but the anger in her tone is unmistakable.
Do you not smell the poison in the air with every breath? Are you not aware of the trees they cut down, the animals they drive to extinction?
I am aware, but predation is part of nature.
This is not predation. It is excess, gluttony, exploitation.
It's impossible for me to argue with that. Ever since Sheehan brought me forward in time, me gob has been more than smacked. It's been practically obliterated by the ruin humans have wrought upon the world. It's not just coastlines that are going to disappear under the waves with these rising temperatures. Plenty of critters will vanish too, and they already are. Like the great extinctions of earlier epochs, except one. All of them were caused by warming global temperatures like this. The Dios are going to accelerate and cascade without a massive correction to carbon emissions. If we survive this day of reckoning, we still have many more days ahead to reckon with. I plan to make sure the druids are ready. When me apprentice visited, the red-haired human... Did he help the Amazon in any way? Improve the conditions here?
Yes, he was a rare human.
He still is. He's a druid like me, and he's fighting the giant that caused the fire, for your sake and everyone else's. He nurtures the earth like you, and I am training more druids right now. One of them was born near here. His name is Oscar. Another was born at the other end of the Amazon River, and his name is Luis. And when their training is complete, I am sure one or both of them will wish to return here to protect the creatures of this forest.
The creatures would not need protection if it were not for these humans. Ridding this place of humans will let the balance return.
No, it won't. It would be disaster.
How? They are the problem. Remove the problem and balance returns.
They have built systems that will inflict ruin on the rivers and forest here without maintenance. I have no idea if that's true or not, but it sounds good.
What systems? What ruin could be greater than what they have already inflicted?
Ah, bollocks. I've gone and bent myself over for one of those Amazon snakes, haven't I? Sheahan surpassed me in slinging shite long ago, but it's not like I never gave him any lessons in the fine art of prevarication. He just had some natural talent to add to my own legendary instruction. Their power and sanitation systems will release pollutants into the river.
They already do that.
But it could be so much worse. And even I can hear how lame that sounds. So much for me legendary skills. The problem with this is that I'm arguing with a force of nature. Humans have few redeeming qualities from nature's point of view. I can't appeal to Pachamama's appreciation of art, or music, or theater, when she's honestly not a fan of any of that. But perhaps I can appeal to her sense of self. I've come to ask ye to stop on behalf of the Amazon Elemental, which is one of the elementals that supports you. Stop this slaughter and let me and the other druids protect and improve the land. Stop and return to being the nurturing mother you are. The great head with colonies of army ants for eyes turns from me and looks back across the river. Her posture slumps, and she returns her gaze to me and pivots in my direction, placing her hands on her wide hips, everything still a boil of plants and chattering, squawking animals.
You will protect me? Protect this land?
I will. And like I said, I have two apprentices who will most likely spend much of their time in this region when they're ready.
Then help me, druid. Be faithful to your word. The fire is to the north, burning out the heart of me.
Will you stop killing the humans in the city?
It is done. I return to myself.
Her massive form contracts briefly, and then the birds all leave it in an explosion of feathers. The monkeys climb down the sapling skeleton or leap into the tops of neighboring trees. Insects scurry down the boles or fly away. The sloth I'd bound me mind to slowly crawls off the ankle, rapidly outpaced by all the other animals returning to the forest. As the animals disperse, I can see them more clearly as individuals. And I'm overwhelmed by the variety of them. I see a capybara, an anteater, some giant feckin' spiders that look like they could pull out me teeth with their calicery, and a procession of mantises intent on finding a quiet spot to mate and then snack on some heads. Looking closer, I realize quite a few of the animals are suddenly in a reproductive mood. I'm standing in the midst of an incipient orgy. Pachamama is reaffirming her commitment to life. A guilty reaction, perhaps, to what she'd just done. I don't think she'd ever dreamed of turning violent. She'd simply been pushed to believe she had no other choice. And when I pointed out that she still had one, she was only too glad to return to peace. She is beautiful, and I tell her so. The sloth responds instead.
Oh, hey. Thanks, man. I get people saying I'm cute sometimes. Or slower than a snail hitching a ride on a tortoise, but never beautiful.
I was talking to Pachamama.
Oh, she's gone. Sorry.
Even as she speaks, the skeleton of saplings falls in a controlled pattern to the forest floor. It's all right. You're beautiful too. Thanks for being our relay.
No problem,
she says, then amends that with a mental sigh.
Except for getting back to the tree I was munching on, that's gonna take all day.
Is it that far?
No, I'm just that slow.
Why? It looks like you could move faster if you wanted.
Oh, I totally can. When that fireball hit near me, you can bet I moved faster than I ever have. But I have to conserve my energy. I eat rubbery leaves, and it's a bit of a drag. I mean, they're delicious, don't get me wrong, but wow, they take forever to digest. And they don't leave me enough juice to be monkeying around.
You know where the fire is?
Yeah, for reals.
I need to go there. You can ride on my back if you'll show me the way.
You sure? I have bugs and stuff living on me.
That's fine. They won't bother me. What's your name, anyway?
Slow-mo, no-mo, bro-do-ly.
I'm Owen.
I thought you were Oaken, Druid of Gaia.
Right, that too. But you can just call me Oaken if you want.
Awesome. Thanks, Oaken.
Would it be okay if I called you Slow-mo for short?
Sure.
I move over next to her, and she rises on her hind feet at roughly the pace of an advancing glacier. I fear I might need some more immortality before we get anywhere. Listen, Slow-mo, I'm going to give you some energy. You won't need to conserve it, and you can move faster.
How?
Druidry.
No, I was gonna say, how fast? Like, monkey fast? Because that would be a lot of energy.
We can try it. I arrange the bindings for both strength and speed, because I'm curious to see what speed equates to for such a creature. I have to admit she's feckin' adorable up close. A white-furred face with a stripe of black fur across the eyes, and some coarse bushy brown fur at the top of her head and all over the rest of her. Black nose and muzzle, but the pattern of fur at the edges curls up a wee bit, giving her the appearance of wearing a perpetual soft smile. Her mental voice is kind of like that too, quietly amused. But gods below, she's got some long claws! When the bindings hit her, Slow-mo's eyes pop wide, and that smile becomes a genuine open-mouthed grin.
Wow, Oaken! This is some amazing juice! Watch out! I'm coming on board!
I have to admit that when she spreads out those long arms with those claws of hers and leaps at me, it's damn hard to stand still. But I do, figuring I can heal if she does me any damage. And it's not bad at all. I grunt under the impact and the weight, but she's gentle and hugs me more with her arms and legs, rather than digging in with those claws.
Wow, Oaken! This feels amazing! I feel like I can achieve true monkey velocity, swinging through the trees like I've always dreamed!
You really have a thing for monkeys, don't you?
Well, they're so fast! I think it's because they can eat yellow tube fuel.
You mean bananas?
What? That's a terrible name for them. Makes no sense at all. Yellow tube fuel is more accurate. Go that way a little bit.
She extends her left arm out past me head and points, and I adjust course to match.
Good. So are all Oaken druids big hairy things like you?
Nah, I'm not even a big hairy thing.
I'm pretty sure you are.
Right now I'm bound to the shape of a black bear. Sometimes I'm a kite, sometimes I'm a ram, or even a walrus. But normally I'm a human, an old human, who looks like a middle-aged human.
These pictures in my head, these are real animals? I've never seen any of them before, except humans. I've seen some of them, but mostly they have darker skin than you.
I've never seen an animal like you before. The world is a very big place. It's not all forest, you know.
It's not? What else is there?
Oceans full of fish. Deserts full of scorpions and cactus. Mountains covered in trees that have needles instead of leaves. Vast plains populated by buffalo and antelope. And so much more, really. I'm still learning about it myself. Every day, it seems, I meet something new and wonderful.
That sounds great. It's all monkeys and leaves and bird brains around here. Whoa! Smell that smoke? We're getting close.
I smell it.
We're probably close enough, actually. I don't like fire, Oaken.
I don't either. I have to put it out, though, for Pachamama's sake and all the animals that live around here.
My tree is probably burned down now. I almost got hit when the fire came down from the sky.
You can find another tree, though, right?
Oh, sure. That was just gonna be my tree for a while. I had named it Lopoyamalachamanaowe, and it said it liked that.
Trees talk to you?
Of course, trees are always talking, but most creatures move too fast to hear them. Trees try to say hi to most everything that passes through their branches because they're friendly like that and so happy when animals come to visit. But by the time they're finished saying hello, the animals have usually already moved on. You have to be willing to hang around and really listen. That's my specialty.
You are full of surprises, Shlomo. I have an apprentice named Tuya who would really like to hear that and learn how to talk to trees. Okay, I need to shift to human and take care of the fire. Why don't you hang out in one of the trees near here and we can talk more later if you like.
Okay, Oaken, that would be great. Can it be that tree right there?
I head over to the right where she's pointing and stop next to the trunk. I don't even know what kind of tree it is, but I wonder already what she'll name it. All right, you have all that energy, so I want you to scamper up that tree like a proper monkey now. Pretend you just ate some yellow tube fuel. Slow-mo scratches me a wee bit as she launches herself at the tree and scrambles up it with those claws, but it's totally worth it. She's fast like she's always dreamed, and her glee at being alive in the world is wonderful to hear right now, when there's a gobshite trying to burn the whole thing down.
Whoa!
She cries out in me head, and she makes some noises like that with her vocal cords, too. It might be actual words in Slothian language, and not simply an exclamation, but I can't be sure. But I can be sure she's happy. She's having a grand old time, monkeying around like the monkeys do. I shapeshift a human and warn her that the energy's about to run out, so she should probably get herself settled. She scampers higher up and dangles from a branch, surrounded by many leaves, all within easy reach.
Okay. I'm ready to be a sloth again,
she tells me. And I dissolve the bindings. Is that okay?
It's quite a difference. But for a little while, I out-monkeyed a monkey. I sure hope this was all real, and not some bad leaf trip.
It's real. Do you get bad leaf trips often?
I meant to say good leaf trip. Hey, you're not big and hairy anymore. I mean, you're hairy, but only in a few places.
This is what I look like as a human.
Most humans I've seen wear something to cover up their middle. Why do they do that? Is it because you have a smaller patch of fur there and a tiny snake living in it?
That's not a tiny snake.
Pretty sure it's not a big snake.
It's not a snake at all. Look, never mind that. I'm glad you're safe now. I'll deal with the fire and return. Dealing with a fire isn't even a little bit of fun. It's hot and smoky and a feckin' shame because a lot of plants and animals died here. But for some reason I'm smiling the whole time I'm crafting bindings, smothering the flames with dirt. The reason is Slow-Mo. She makes me laugh. And she's seeing the world in a way that's fresh to me old eyes. I suppose because she's seen even less of it than I have. But she sees it with a sense of wonder, like me apprentices do. I think it's good for me to see that. It renews me own sense of wonder. When you get old, you can get tricked into thinking there's nothing new to enjoy in the world. Because you slow down. You don't see much except the same few things. And you think, feckin' hells, why don't I just lie down, tits up, and give up the ghost? I'm bored with eating soft foods and watching game shows and getting dressed, because clothes are all shite and scratchy. There's no doubt that having me youth restored has gone a long way to renewing me love for the world, and seeing so much of it recently has renewed me willingness to fight for it. Not that I've ever been unwilling to fight, it's just that I'm starting to feel more zealous about fighting to defend Gaia. Perhaps Granuel's attitude is rubbing off on me. Or perhaps when you know what the world once was like and you see what humans have done to it, you just get fighting mad as a matter of course. When the fire's finally out, I can feel the forest relax. I've kept me word, and Pachamama can return to nurturing all. I'm relieved that she listened to me and stopped what she was doing without a fight. Perhaps she stopped because she saw that I'm on her side. But I'm sure she knew that the true fight is going to rage for quite a while. And I'm going to be the one fighting it for her. I let Amazon know the work is done, and I'll be up a tree for a while. Then I shift to a red kite and fly back to where Slow-Mo No-Mo Broderly is hanging out, chewing on a rubbery leaf. "How's me favorite sloth?" I ask her.
"Whoa. Oh, Ken, is that you?"
"It is."
"I hear you in my head, but I'm not sure where you are."
"I'm the bird perched on the branch above you. A red kite, to be specific."
"Wow! You have wings! You can fly! I bet you feel really good about that."
"I do."
"You're magic, Oaken."
"No, it's not me so much, but the earth that's magical."
"I'm pretty sure you're magic."
"Tell me more about yourself, Slow-Mo. What's it like to live here? I'd like to hear some of your adventures."
"Is it okay that most of them begin with me dangling upside down like this?"
"Of course. An adventure without dangling is no adventure at all."
"Whoa. Really? That means practically my whole life is an adventure. I never realized."
"That's okay, love. Few people do."
Chapter 17. The Thor I'd met in the past and watched die under the blade of Moraltah had worn blonde hair, which was different from the Edda's, where he had bright red or even orange hair, but it wasn't a detail I'd worried about at the time. People can have whatever color hair they want, so I imagine gods could figure out some way to do the same. Everything else had matched the old stories. He drove a chariot pulled by flying goats, he wielded Mjolnir, and he had the ability to sling lightning around like a painter applying gouache to a canvas. So is this Thor re-manifested, due to the significant number of pagans who still worshipped him around the world, or had this been the real Thor all along, and Leif had slain some other convincing manifestation? Either way, I'd been played, and when my eyes slid to Odin, I saw him staring back at me with a huge grin on his face. He laughed, openly, at my expression, Freya caught it, and she looked my way as well, and her smile was anything but friendly. I don't often get a cold, squirmy feeling of fear in the pit of my stomach, but when I do, it's because I realize I'm surrounded by enemies on all sides, and I'm most likely not going to survive the day. Or maybe I'm going to suffer something worse than death. The assembled deities were rather famous for doling out such punishments, and Jesus had warned me on more than one occasion I would suffer more pain than I'd ever known as a result of my invasion of Asgard. It was a debt he'd made clear I would one day have to pay, and every instinct I had told me I should flee the field now, because that day had come. The Aesir had the Fae, the Dark Elves, and some significant Greco-Roman assistants ready to meet Loki in Hell. Chances were I wasn't going to sway the battle all by myself. I'd already taken care of Jormungandr, or rather, Lakshya had, but eliminating him had been the specific request Odin had made of me in lieu of a blood price for Thor's supposed death. My oath was fulfilled, though it was apparently extracted from me based on a lie. My obligations were quite thoroughly discharged, except for the greater obligation I had to Gaia. Should Loki's forces break through, the destruction they would wreak on the world, the lives lost, would be incalculable. And just as I believed Jesus when he said I had a whole lot of pain coming my way, I also believed him when he said I was one of the few who could minimize the destructive consequences of this mess. By taking out Jormungandr, Lakshya had certainly saved many people and plenty of livestock. The Yeti had saved more by stopping Surt before he could erupt for more than a few minutes. If I could save anyone by staying, I had to do it. Surprising everyone, Fan sounded the charge first and led the Fae into battle with Munnan and McLear by her side, winged pixies and sprites floating above a motley horde of boggarts, barguests, spriggans, and other creatures. Briette followed close behind with her host, almost indistinguishable from Fan's except in proportions of this type of fairy or that. I followed close behind them, figuring they were a safer bet for me than joining any portion of the Aesir forces. A wedge of Draugr advanced to meet them from the volcano slopes, and I realized after a few seconds that it was proportional. But whereas the combined Fae host was a significant chunk of our forces, it was only a sliver of theirs. The scale of what we faced sank in, and that cold tremor in my stomach shivered and solidified into a block of ice. Speaking of which, the two surviving Yeti marched with Munnanan, whirling blades at the ready since their frost magic would be minimally effective against the Draugr. I didn't like them being at the front. They had already sacrificed enough, and I didn't want the Yeti to be erased from the earth. There was also a small forest of Yumen. Good call bringing them along. They were hard to kill. I had to break into a slow jog to keep up. The charge was not a full-speed plunge into clashing weapons just yet, but it would build. Casting a glance over my shoulder, I saw Odin nod to the Olympians. Zeus ordered them to fall in behind us, and he led the way, gliding obscenely above the field with his battle boner, a savage grin peeking through his beard. Thunderheads roiled above us now. With Zeus, Jupiter, and Thor on the field, there would be plenty of thunder and lightning. I wondered where Perun was, thinking that his friendly, hairy personage would be a welcome addition to this battle, but he was no doubt occupied elsewhere with his troubles in his Slavic lands. It would be a certainty that the Sisters of the Three Auroras were protecting people in Poland. We kept closing the distance, and I periodically checked behind to see how the armies would deploy. They were obviously deferring to Odin, and I wondered why I never got that memo, or a nice outline of the battle plan, highlighted in neon colors and annotated in red pen. Had Fan's charge been the plan all along, or was Odin improvising according to developments on the field? At least he wasn't smiling at me in mockery anymore. With any luck, I had not deployed as he expected, though I'm sure that whatever Odin had planned for me, he had already thought through multiple scenarios. The Svartalfar did not fall in behind, but rather advanced on the left to flank, and that would require a response at some point from the Draugr. The Alfar spread out to the right flank. Yes, probably wise to keep them away from the Svartalfar. The dwarfs, with their rune-carved weapons, reinforced the middle, the Vanir behind them, and then, finally, the tightly packed ranks of the Einherjar advanced, shields and axes ready. I pumped myself up with bindings for strength and speed, and then cast camouflage as well, even though it was an energy hog. If there was ever a time not to hold back, this was it. I needed every advantage Gaia was willing to give me. The Fae hosts began to move faster, a roar of defiant voices, Doppler shifting louder and louder, venting their rage and stress as all living creatures asked themselves why they were rushing toward their probable deaths and struggled to come up with a reason that was worth it. Mere orders didn't really cut it, not when you have time to think about what's coming, and not once you realize you're probably going to get cut down, but you'd be cut down for deserting as well. The only way out is through. And that's where battle cries come from. An abyss of desperation and sheer utter rage that someone is standing in the way of your own safety and the safety of those you love. I didn't see the actual first clash of the armies, since I was somewhat to the rear of the initial action. But I heard the clang of metal and the death grunts and smelled the spray of blood, saw the lines of fighters in front of me crumple together like an accordion, saw the pixies surge forward in pairs, razor wire held between them as they flew on either side of the Draugr and clotheslined them at the throat, neatly slicing through them so that their heads toppled off like unbalanced watermelons. It took all their strength to do that, though, so they had to ascend rapidly and loop around after each kill to build up speed again. Some of them didn't climb fast enough and got cut down. Some of the Draugr saw them coming and became incorporeal in time, so that the wire passed through them harmlessly, which meant the pixies could continue forward or try to come around for another pass, and when one pixie opted for one thing and the other didn't, it ruined the attack. One or more of the pixies died and the razor wire got dropped. Which is not to say they made no difference, they did. They must have cut through close to a third of the necks they set out to sever, and that eased the first crush just enough to keep from getting overwhelmed, though it was a close thing. We knew the weakness of the Draugr, and they knew it too. They were prepared to parry a swipe at their heads, and then they got to counterstrike anywhere because their opponents were vulnerable everywhere. The Draugr were brutal, strong, and effective warriors, if not especially creative. They absorbed any damage to their bodies and simply kept coming. Death rattles quaking in the air as they took joy in slaying without consequences, for they could suffer no fate worse than they had already suffered in hell, and returning there would be returning home now. The helmets were proving problematic for most of the Fae. They were providing just enough protection to keep the Draugr standing after the first blow, and they rarely had to absorb a second. Many of the Fae were falling as a result, and I felt ineffective. I couldn't very well go through the middle of the Fae lines without potentially doing them harm with my cold iron aura. So I sprinted around to the right flank where the Alfar were advancing, keeping the Fae between me and the Dark Elves on the left. There I could finally join battle myself and be grateful once again to the ancient enchantment on Fragora's blade that allowed it to cut through any armor. The Draugr had no protection against my sword, and it cut through necks or crunched through skulls quite well. I could at least hold my own against them, even if their endless numbers meant I could not advance. The Fae did not enjoy any such advantages. They were getting cut down as often as not, a 1-to-1 ratio that didn't favor our side when we were already so outnumbered. We could hope for reinforcements. The Norse and Olympian gods had yet to wade into the melee, but they would need to do far better. The Alfar and Svartalfar pinched in from either side, and while both had a visible impact, it was the Dark Elves that proved to be far more effective. Their ability to become incorporeal served them well against similar abilities of the Draugr. They dissolved into smoke, using the discipline they called Sigar Afreker, and then materialized inside the guards of their targets, thrusting black blades up underneath the chin and into the brain. The left side of the field began to visibly wilt under that onslaught, just as the Fae line visibly crumpled before the Draugr. The Alfar, to my mind, were doing very little to reduce the Draugr numbers. They had shields and terrific armor that protected them against the Draugr strikes, but made few killing blows of their own. They earned a biscuit for suffering few losses and containing the enemy, I supposed. But they weren't winning the battle so much as not losing. And then hell got involved, unseen somewhere in the back, having shrunk along with Loki to normal size. But her influence on the battle was outsized in proportion. She took control of the fallen Fae, those that still had their heads anyway, and raised their corpses from the dead to turn and fight against their former comrades. Pixies and pumpkinheads, spriggans and sprites all rose from the field and turned on their erstwhile friends, thrusting bronze swords and spears into living bodies, faces lit with surprised expressions as they died. Since Fand and Munanin were at the front, they were among the first to be attacked. And Munanin didn't care. He just kept with the hewing and cleaving. He was wielding Moraltaw, the blade that spread necrosis through the body with a single cut, and that Leif Helgerson had used to slay whatever iteration of Thor that had been. Against Draugr, it worked well, surprisingly, since they were already dead. But part of their flesh must still have responded to nerve impulses, and Moraltaw's infection made sure they couldn't, so they collapsed, doubly dead without being beheaded. The Fae fell to its iron content as much as to its enchantment, and Munanin put them down for good. But Fand wasn't able to defend herself against her own beloved Fae. Or perhaps she would have, given time enough to think it through. What happened instead was that she froze, confronted with a reanimated Spriggan she quite probably knew by name and had seen fall moments before. And it did not hesitate to take advantage of her hesitation. Its wooden digits, already lengthened and sharpened into claws, it closed in, heedless of its own defense, and I saw Fan's mouth drop open in shock, then widen further along with her eyes as the Spriggan's deadly claws punched through a gap in her armor and pierced something vital. She must have cried out, though I couldn't hear it, and the light winked out in her eyes as she slumped, already dead before she hit the ground. Being in camouflage allowed me a bit of time to pick and choose my targets, since the Draugr in front of me were uncertain what seemed to be killing all their buddies. They came in slowly, but they kept coming, and I hacked a few more down in panic because I had a horrible premonition of what would happen next. Fand and I had never gotten along, but she was deeply loved by the Fae and by Munanin MacLear, and Munanin was someone I did admire and respect, and with whom I'd enjoyed a long history, even friendship. I hurt for him instantly and felt hot tears watering the corners of my eyes. I had to take care of two more Draugr before I could glance over again, and that's when Munanin realized that his wife had fallen, because the same Spriggan who'd killed her tried to take him out too. The strike on his right side failed to penetrate his armor, and the bite of Moraltaw put the Spriggan down, but he realized he shouldn't have taken an attack from that side unless Fand was no longer protecting it. He looked down, saw her still and beyond care, and he fell to his knees beside her, throwing his sword away to gather her up in his arms and scream her name to bring her spirit back to this side of the veil. That was precisely what I'd feared. The undead Fae and the Draugr didn't stop to let him mourn. They kept coming, as they kept coming at me. I beheaded another Draugr, flicked my eyes briefly to the left and saw multiple attackers cut down the grief-stricken Munanin MacLear, one of the eldest and most noble of the Tuatha De Danann, far more a god of love in his behavior than Angus Og ever was, a man capable of loving and giving to all, and he would never have come to this end if it weren't for me. I went on a bit of a tear after that, hacking through these confused spirits in long-dead husks who had no particular motivation to press on except to escape hell for a while. "I'm so sorry, Munanin," I said, wondering if those words would ever reach his ears, somewhere in Tir na n'Og on the other side of the veil. When I was next able to look over, the Fae host was in full retreat, demoralized completely by the deaths of their leaders and the realization that should they die, their corpses would rise to fight those who remained. A maddening, amplified laugh bubbled up from the vicinity of the volcano. Loki was amused. Some of the Fae rallied to Bree its fire. She was again airborne on a pillar of flame, looking invincible in that armor she'd forged herself. But most of Fan's army was broken, streaking back to the point where they'd shifted into the plain. The lone bright spot was the Yeti, Adrun and Isilver, who could not be overwhelmed and whose whirling blades were devastating against the Draugr. They slowed and disoriented attackers with sprays of frost to the face, then stabbed them with the tip of those blades that drank the soul within, no decapitation necessary. When they saw Munanin fall, they rallied to his side and beat back the swarm of undead Fae, even as the living Fae broke into a retreat. Then Isilver held off multiple attackers, while Adrun encased her father and Fan together in a block of ice, to prevent them from being reanimated by hell. She pushed them along a slick track of ice she created toward Briet's forces, with Isilver and then the human covering their retreat. I rather hoped the Yeti would simply continue to the south and leave the field, for both their victories and their losses already exceeded anyone else's. I had no illusions that the Fae who joined with Briet's forces to fight in the second wave represented anything but a few individual triumphs. In the first clash, we'd been routed, gods had fallen, and the forces of Loki and Hel had only been strengthened by fresh meat for the Necromancer's commands. The Dark Elves were already tiring, and the Alfar were doing little but maintaining the right flank, and they were themselves in danger of being flanked by the remainder of Hel's army. We would need to do much better, or the people of Sweden would never see the sunrise. Nor, for that matter, would much of Europe. Chapter 18 Yama King Wuguan looks like the sort of fighter that relies on brute strength to win the day. He'll gladly take some hits so long as he gets in a good one on you, because he thinks one is all it will take. And maybe he's right. Even if he doesn't finish me like One Punch Man, an anime hero I've been enjoying recently, he'll probably do enough damage that he can administer the coup de grace with little resistance. So it's probably best that I get out of the way of his leap. I can't engage his sword when it's way above my head, and I feel that this is a test somehow. Wukong clearly wishes to see if I can defeat Wuguan before he teaches me anything else, and I suppose it's fair. If we're supposed to fight 8 progressively tougher Yama Kings, I should be able to defeat the guy at the halfway point if I expect to stick around until the end. Is it perhaps a test for Wuguan as well? Is he trying to move up in the hierarchy of Dihu, or perhaps escape it entirely for a cushier job in one of the heavens? I know nothing about him or what must be his very long history, other than what I see. It occurs to me as I scramble to my right, Wuguan's left, that I've been fighting alongside beings that are older than Atticus, and that's the sort of realization that can make you feel pretty small when you're only in your 30s, especially since I've gradually gotten a sense of the scale that such a lifetime represents after listening to Atticus's stories. He lived 19 centuries or so without access to plumbing, for example, which makes me cringe. The few times I've had to go without a toilet were unhappy and uncomfortable, and I kept thinking about what could bite me. He must think we're all pampered hedonists. I take nothing for granted regarding Wuguan's leaps, because if he could skate around in the air like the Monkey King, then normal physics would not apply. I automatically execute a blocking maneuver for an attack that isn't there yet, but abruptly arrives a moment later. The impact nearly rips Scowager from my hand. He does have those abilities. He's as strong as I feared, and he is much faster than his bulk would suggest. The battle continues to rage around us, but a space is cleared somehow for our duel. The damned must have received some signal. There must be plenty riding on this for both of us. The Monkey King and his clones are still fighting the rest of the demons and the damned all around the mountain, protecting the people of Taipei and not simply watching the duel, except in brief glances. I don't understand why I was singled out for this, but I doubt Wuguan will pause to explain, and I doubt I will have much time to win. If he's in Wukong's class as a fighter, then he outclasses me. Wukong pointed out on the roof of his shop that my fighting patterns are recognizable and easily countered. They are essentially Chinese methods that Atticus taught me, after all, and old ones at that, so old that they're almost new again. But Wuguan knows them as Wukong does. I show him something he's going to recognize and counter, then mix in something he doesn't. My staff whirls around in my right, and he expects it to land in my left hand. So he slaps it away, expecting me to be open to counter-strike, and I will be, except that I've palmed a knife and thrown it at his right eye, while his arm and sword were out of position, a gamble that pays off as it sinks home. His reflexive flinch ruins his counter-strike, but he surprises me with a stiff kick to the midsection as I try to close in, covering his retreat. He's annoyed to be feeling pain instead of dealing it, and I'm out of breath and on my ass, my diaphragm bruised and a couple of ribs cracked. He yanks the knife out of his eye and tosses it at me, and I'm able to roll in time to have it sink into my left upper arm instead of my own eye. I pull it out and crank the healing on high. We both take time to reset after that. He presents his left side, sword held defensively, so that he can keep his remaining eye on me. I roll to my feet and wonder how I'm going to surprise him now that he's wary. He still has a tremendous advantage in strength and reach. In the plus column, he won't want to be taking those huge leaps anymore, for fear I'll get around to his blind side. In the minus column, that armor means he's not vulnerable anywhere else to a knife throw, and now he's going to be guarding that weakness intensely. Which might be good? I check to confirm that I have 2 throwing knives left. I palm one in my right hand and twirl it. That's right, big guy. Look at the shiny knifey. A couple of twirls with the staff in my left while I'm still twirling the knife in my right, and I'm watching how his eye tracks this. He flickers to the staff, but keeps his eye on my knife and also on my hips to watch for telltales there. Good. Movements with my left arm and wrist he won't be watching, or he's confident he knows what I'll be doing there. That's where I need to surprise him. I lunge forward with a conventional attack and throw the knife to see what he does. He blocks the staff and ducks the knife, then slashes at me with a damn fast cut that would have taken off my beard if I had one. Good to know. I pluck out my last knife and make the same throwing motion but don't release. He buys the feint, and I do a double tap with Scowager wielded in my left hand, once on the flat of his blade, knocking it aside, then thrusting forward into the space where I think his cheek will be as he ducks my phantom throw, and it connects hard. He howls and staggers back, that left eye now instinctively closed, and he can't see until he opens it again. I throw the knife for real this time, and it sinks into his throat. He's losing blood and is unable to breathe in addition to having trouble seeing, so he's not at the top of his game when I come in to finish him. I tee off on his face and he falls backward, his head a shattered mess inside his helmet. Fare thee well, Wu Guan. His death, or rather his melting away, has the curious effect of destroying all his minions a minute later. They converged on me after the duel, but then exploded into goo before I could engage more than two of them. The mountain is clear, and I'm expecting the Monkey King to give me some approval at this point. But instead, when I look at him, he leans on his staff and frowns.
You could have let that go on a little longer,
he says. That makes absolutely no sense to me, and I say as much. What? Why would I increase my risk that way?
You defeated him so quickly that he lost face and recalled all his souls.
But that's good, right? We won. People are safe. Wukong shakes his head and waggles his hand at me.
Four more Yama Kings to go. And now that you've humiliated one of them, they'll be coming for you. Not Taipei, not the mainland. You.
Oh. Well, that's just great. You could have warned me ahead of time that in addition to my own life or death, I'd have to worry about fragile egos, too.
I didn't think it would be necessary. Fragile egos are at the root of almost every conflict. My ego is certainly what motivated me in my younger years. Did you know that I once demanded to be called the Great Sage, equal to heaven?
I throw up a hand to stifle a laugh and try to turn it into a cough. I may have read some stories that mentioned that. He's not fooled.
You may laugh. I deserve it. But I am no longer of that mind, and I have a different name now.
Yes, I've heard. The Buddha victorious in strife. May I ask?
Of course.
Why is a Buddha spending his time serving bubble tea? He shrugs.
It is a simple pleasure that tends to make people happy. And when they see that they can be made happy by something so simple, then all their other grand desires seem silly by comparison. For indeed they are. A Buddhist wishes to point out that desires are what prevent people from achieving happiness, that materialism is the cause of discord. The simple pleasure of bubble tea gets them to a receptive place to hear that message, or to reinforce that message if they've already heard it.
I suddenly cannot keep myself from smiling as I mentally take note of what I'm doing. I am talking to the Monkey King in Taiwan about Buddhism. My life has become far more dangerous since becoming a druid, but at the same time I get to talk to living legends. It's at that point that Seven Star Mountain explodes again.
Chapter 19. Shlomo tells me of the bird she likes, and the bird she doesn't. The insects who bite and who leave her alone. The monkeys screeching and leaping around her, eating yellow tube fuel. The colorful moths and butterflies snapped up by croaking frogs. The thrilling quiet that settles in the forest when the jaguars pass through. Her occasional half-hearted yearnings to find a mate. But even yearning was more energy than she wanted to expend.
Mostly you have to have perspective. Is anything short of teeth coming in my face worth burning more than the basic calories I need to eat and not fall out of the tree? The answer is no. Except for swinging around like a monkey, that was totally worth the calories. Because I didn't have to burn them, they were free, like sunshine.
What about things that make you happy? Aren't those things worth burning some calories for?
Well, sure, but what makes me happy is not moving very much.
How can you say that? You just said you've never been happier than when you moved like a monkey.
I'm complicated. There's a lot of nuance you're missing here.
I can handle nuance. Bring me the nuance.
Okay. You asked for it.
And then me mind is bombarded by images and emotions, all relating to a sliding scale of satisfaction with staying still through a wide range of environmental factors. Bearing witness to frenetic activity while remaining almost motionless gives Slow-Mo great pleasure. But she can visualize and imagine things so well. When I ask her why that is, she replies,
"Well, you have to imagine quite a bit when you're incapable of moving very fast or doing all the things other creatures do."
Would you like to see more of the world? Move fast like he did more often? I ask her.
Sure. But wishing won't make it so.
You don't have to wish for it. You can come with me. I'll show you a few places.
Places where those buffalo things roam?
If you like. Deserts, oceans, mountains.
But aren't those far away?
Yes, but I can move very fast.
Won't they have a disturbing lack of leaves?
We can bring some with us, or just come back quickly before you get hungry again. Slow-mo, no more broadly, chews on the idea, along with a leaf, slowly enough that I can hear the exquisite crunch and grind of her teeth, and perhaps the churning of metaphorical gears in her head. When she finishes, her eyes refocus on me, and she nods, upside down.
Okay, Oaken. I'd like to see some of those things.
Great! Well, I have some questions first. How old are you? She answers, and I continue to ask, absorbing as many basic facts as I can and combining them with a fluid understanding of her personality, so that I'll be able to shift with her safely. And in truth, there is no hurry until I'm asked to be somewhere again. A couple of hours pass with her sharing her life with me in pictures and feelings, and I can sense I'm getting attached to the lass. She doesn't like toucans, for example, because they have wee beady eyes of death and huge beaks.
The large, colorful beaks, she explains, are there to distract you from the eyes. If you look into a toucan's eyes, you will know the heart of evil. And what's more, you will know they'd like to eat you.
What? They're meat eaters?
I don't really think so. I'm not sure. But the eyes, Owen, you have to listen to what the eyes are telling you. They always say that even though they don't normally enjoy meat, they would make an exception just for you. And snap your flesh away from your bones with terrible little toucan beak-clacking sounds.
Well, I kind of hope I don't meet any now. That sounds worse than garnishing your cocktail glass with a log of shite instead of a nice lime wedge.
What are cocktails?
I'll have to get you one, I promise her. And then the elemental summons me. I'm needed somewhere in Europe, because some daft donkey cock has gone and messed with powers he shouldn't have. Time to go, I says to Slow-Mo. Ready to see the world?
Sure, Oaken. I'll start moving now, and we can probably leave before the sun comes up.
The sun wasn't down yet, so that's an alarming estimate. I shoot her some more juice, and her eyes pop wide. Bollocks to that. We have to scurry now. Climb down and drape yourself on me back. I'm gonna shift to a human.
I've never scurried before! This is exciting!
I float down to the forest floor and shift to human, and Slow-Mo is ready to hop on after a few seconds. Careful with those claws now. Wrap your arms around me neck and I'll catch ye. She leaps and lands with a grunt, and I grunt as well. She's a bit prickly, not as soft as she might look, because that fur is matted and filthy. My skin begins to tickle. She wasn't lying about the bugs living on her, which I guess are now having a look around at this new thing she's hanging on that isn't a tree. I take time to reach their tiny brains, nothing more than a few nerves, and tell them to stay on Slow-Mo. Not sure they're gonna make the shift, honestly, but they might, as Slow-Mo considers them to be a part of her. I have to jog through the brush and get used to the weight, and it's bouncy for both of us.
Is this a scurry?
A bit. It's also called riding piggyback, though I don't know why. Never seen a single feckin' pig do this. Language is strange.
I hope I get to learn your language. I can teach you Slothian words if you want.
I'd like that. Okay, here we are. This tree is special. We can use it to shift to Tir na n'Og and from there to practically any other place on the planet. But I need you to put one of your hands on that tree.
Whoa. What's Tir na n'Og? There were a lot of images with that.
It's many things. Mostly magic and bollocks. But not magical bollocks, if you take my meaning.
I don't think I do.
Just hold on. We shift through, pulling along the tether, and I hold the wonder of Slow-Mo no-mo broadly in me second headspace, hoping I don't cock it up, for it would be a tragedy if I brought her to any harm. I pause on the other side to check on her. How is that?
Whoa. I mean, wow. Oaken, that was... I don't know. My stomachs are doing flippity-floppity monkey business. It's possible I might.
A hot, juicy something lands on me shoulder and drips down me chest.
Be sick. Yeah. Yeah, it's a sure thing, actually. Sorry. Those were good leaves, too. You know, I think I recognize one of them. I guess I didn't chew that very well because I was so excited about how delicious it looked.
How are your bugs?
My bugs? I imagine they're fine. I still feel them and stuff.
Great. This is Tir na n'Og, full of trees, but not the kind you're used to eating. We're gonna do that one more time, so hold on to your stomachs. I shift to the tether point that Guy wants me to use, though I'm not sure precisely where it is. Somewhere to the north and east of where I was before. In Europe, certainly, but north of the mountains and east of Germany. I might actually be in Poland. I'm not sure where the modern borders are drawn. All I know is that it's quite enough to hear Slow-Mo barf wetly on me shoulder again.
Sorry, Oaken.
It's okay, lass, I tell her, brushing it away. Maybe you'll get used to it, and maybe we won't shift very much from now on.
I like that second idea. So where are we?
On the other side of the world from your jungle. This is across an ocean or two.
It's drier here. I mean, I can feel the air is dry.
Wait until you feel a desert. Okay, I have to find out from the elemental what we're here to do, and then there may be some action.
More.